supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we got another one of those jam-packed shows for you cats and kittens. In the question of the week, we'll talk about gardening on a tabletop. No more bending over. No more bad backs. It's a garden style for everybody. We'll also speak to the people at the Garden Conservancy about their great Open Days program, in which private gardens are preserved, and to help with the preservation, private gardens all over the country are open for tours of people like you for a single day. It's an amazing program, but we better hop right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Ken, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, good to talk with you, Mike.
It's good to talk with you, Ken. Where are you, sir?
I'm in Spokane, Washington.
Oh, always nice to hear from our listeners there. What can we do for Ken in Spokane?
Well, here's my problem. I live in a little rural area just north of town, and I've got a 200-foot-long crushed rock driveway that with the spring rains and when my sprinklers get going, added to that, I get things growing up through the rock in the driveway. So I'm wondering about what I can do to get rid of the things that grow up. And unfortunately, they aren't just weeds, but most of it's grass. So I need something I can use to kill the grass, but not using, you know, the typical commercial stuff that's on the market that's so awful.
Right. And are you a gardener yourself, Ken? Do you grow any vegetables over the summer and everything?
No.
Okay,
I don't. I'm not much of a gardener. I listen regularly, and I've been encouraged to get started in it, but I'm not there yet.
Okay, no, that's good, because you kind of gave yourself up. You kind of gave yourself away when you said the thing growing in your driveway was not a weed. It was grass. Grass is our worst weed, Ken. We vegetable gardeners, we laugh at dandelion, clover, chickweed, purslane, these little plants that come and say hello to our plants until we pull them out or something. But I will tell you, the definition of a weed is a great plant in the wrong place. So I have the same situation as you. Our driveway is crushed stone. It's not a long driveway, but it still has the same issues in that crushed stone, it seems to be an ideal planting medium. There's always soil under it. There's always dirt washing into the stones. And once seeds of plants grow in or the rhizomes creep in sideways, it's almost like a protective cover for them. The stones keep them warm during the cold season. They protect them from overheating during the summer. It's almost like more lawn should be planted on crushed gravel driveways. So, as you may have noticed if you looked in previous questions of the week, the answers that I originally used were I would go out and flame weed my garden. I have a handheld flame weeder from Burns-O-Matic called the Yard and Garden Torch, or the Outdoor Torch. You can also buy high-strength vinegars that are very effective herbicides that are not poisonous to frogs and toads and humans, like the chemical varieties. But I attacked these weeds head-on for the first, 15 years in our house. Then I visited a Frank Lloyd Wright house in Wichita that had permeable blocks for their parking lot. These are sometimes called eco-pavers. They're like specially made driveway pavers that are full of holes. So plants are designed to grow up through them so that when rainwater comes, the rainwater, the stormwater is managed as if it was landing on a lawn. But the pavers keep the surface stable for the parking of cars. And all that they do is they mow it once a month down to around 2 inches. And I looked at this, and I literally, in front of the tour guide, started slapping myself in the head, realizing I was wasting time, I was wasting gas, I was wasting vinegar. I went home, and in one season, I had come up with a plan of just infrequent mowing that allowed actually the driveway to fill in and look beautiful. And it became so much better at drainage because it had all these plants handling the water. You know, when I went out and mowed my lawn, I just mowed the driveway as well. But that's what I did. I got out of the weeding business, went into the mowing business. It's like one-tenth the time, and there's no investment. I'm not constantly buying things.
Yeah, that's great.
All right. Well, good luck, Ken, and let's get you. Come on. There's still plenty of time to get that vegetable garden started this year, pal.
Right. Yep, indeed. Okay.
All right. Take care, man. Bye-bye.
Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Ann, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike. This is Ann. I live in Ardmore, just on the west side of Philadelphia. And I'm finally getting my asparagus bed naked to receive the sun.
Yes, that is a good idea. Presumably that means you had it mulched. I doubt it was wearing a dress and high heels over winter, right?
It was wearing a fancy barnyard dress of hay and tied down with cord to keep it from blowing all over the neighborhood. So my question is, can I chop up this hay with my mower and throw it into my compost bin?
Well, of course you could. But first, I do want to point out that you're doing the right thing. And this is something I haven't talked about this spring and something I may neglect. I did talk about it with a couple of neighbors. And that's what made me realize people don't know this. We often cover our beds with mulch over the winter to keep the soil from freezing and thawing and heaving up out of the ground and to keep weeds down. But what people don't realize is leaving that mulch on in the spring kind of delays the emergence of plants, which you clearly know because you said you're going to pull it back to warm up the soil.
Right.
And everyone who has mulch on their beds should be doing that. You pull off the mulch, you let your spring bulbs come up, or you let the soil warm up, and you put your plants in the ground. And then as quickly as possible, after the soil is warm, you put the mulch back on to prevent weeds. And by the way, I'm presuming that you're using the wrong term. I'm presuming this is straw and not hay.
It doesn't have seed heads of the...
Right. Exactly. And that's the difference. Hay is animal feed. It still has the nutritious grains on top. Straw is like a drinking straw. The grain heads have been removed, and the empty stalks make a great mulch. So you could simply, for instance, transfer your straw to your vegetable garden and use it as a weed-preventing mulch there.
Right. I'm one of those lucky people who has shade in the backyard and sun only in the front yard, so that's where my asparagus is, in the front yard.
Oh, I see. So that's your vegetable garden is the asparagus.
That's my vegetable garden. And I'm hoping that this year to have enough to feed more than just me. I've got 22 feet of asparagus.
And how old is it?
This is about the fifth year.
Okay, yeah. No, you should be reaching critical mass.
Oh, that's great.
This should be a good year for you.
My compost bin has not been very productive as yet. Should I go ahead and buy some compost and spread it on the bed?
Yes, okay. You should definitely feed it, especially towards the end as those spears get thinner, because that's when the crowns are going to replenish themselves for the following year. Now, what is in you have a compost bin, you said. What's in it?
It's only shredded leaves.
Right.
Vegetable peelings and scraps.
Right.
Eggshells, coffee occasionally, no meat, no bread.
But mostly shredded leaves, not overloaded with vegetable waste, or do you think it is getting overloaded with vegetable waste?
No, it's mostly shredded leaves.
If that's the case, if you were a typical springtime gardener who had too much garbage in there and not enough brown material, that hay would be priceless. Right now, I'd say it's entirely up to you. You described the size of your asparagus bed, so I'm figuring there's like one whole bale of straw on top of it?
Yes.
If you took that bale of straw chopped it up finely, mixed it with 5 pounds of wet coffee grounds, which you can get from any coffee shop. Any coffee shop will be happy to save and give you their grounds. That would turn into super premium compost.
And
it
that's terrific.
It would be the kind of nitrogen-rich compost that your asparagus really likes. Your asparagus wants compost that had some poultry manure or well-composted horse manure or coffee grounds or something like that. If you could even find a good source of composted horse manure, that's the classic thing to feed asparagus with because it's not a fruiting plant. It only really wants nitrogen and a little bit of phosphorus and potassium.
Well, that'll be an interesting thing for me to look for, but I'll go visit some cousins in Lancaster County.
But in the meantime, if you shred that stuff up real good, mix it with a lot of coffee grounds, you'll have some nice compost to feed your asparagus with, and it'll be very specifically good for the asparagus.
Okay, well, I'll cosset the asparagus and come on over and have some.
All right. I'll bring the butter.
Thanks so much, Mike.
My pleasure, Ann. Good luck this year.
Thanks. Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody with a severe case of spring fever that a couple of warm days does not mean you can plant tomatoes and other crops this summer. First, find your average last frost-free date, and then keep checking the 10-day forecast around that date. And don't put tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, and other heat-seeking missiles outside until your nighttime temps are reliably going to stay in the mid-50s. But don't go bringing your brandy wines back inside just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls, how to garden on a tabletop, and the Open Days program that opens up private gardens in your area for a single day once every year. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Verpy supports You Bet Your Garden. Verpy can help do the gardening for you with garden-ready plants. Tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, herbs, and more, delivered at planting time in your region. These and more can be seen online at verpy.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up a little later in the show, are you tired of bending over? It's early in the season, and I already am. We're going to talk about how you can grow an entire summertime garden on top of a table. We're also going to take lots more of your fabulous phone calls. But now it's time to welcome our special guest, Laura Palmer, Deputy Director for Administration of the Garden Conservancy and Director of the fabulous Open Days program since its first season in 1995. Laura, welcome back to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike. I'm happy to be here.
We are happy to have you. As you know, I have always been a big fan of the Open Days program. Just a little background, the Garden Conservancy is a group that preserves private gardens around the country that would otherwise be bulldozed or left to ruin. And to fund that preservation and to get the news out, you hold these fabulous open days where these are totally private gardens, right, that you've scoped out. These are people's fabulous landscaped houses that that are Brigadoon. They're open to the public one day a year.
That's right. That's right. Every single one of them is private. We do list a lot of public gardens through the program, but we have 311 gardens that are produced and maintained by their owners.
And you say 311, that's the number that is on this year's Open Days program?
That's right. We have 311 in 18 different states around the country.
And the way you work this is when you're in a certain area, it's 1 or 2 days that all the gardens in that area are open. So kind of in baseball language, it's hitting a ball into a corner. You can take as many as you can get to, right?
That's right, except unless you're live in the Northeast, where in New York and Connecticut and New Jersey, we open gardens beginning in April and all the way through early November. There's just about every weekend an open day.
Now, when you first started in 1995, I remember I was the editor of Organic Gardening magazine. That's how long ago that was.
That's right.
And we relied then heavily on the book. You published this big paperback book that gives you a state-by-state rundown of the open days dates and details about the specific gardens. And you still do the book, but most people go online for that information now, don't they?
That's right. We're pretty digital, and most of the gardens are available through our website. It's a searchable database, and you can also print driving directions and pretty good maps to get you from one to the next. Of course, some of our owners prefer not to have their information on the website, but you can always call our toll-free number, and we can give you that information, too.
And the website, you know, I guess you can get at it through the Garden Conservancy. The one I have in front of me is opendaysprogram.org.
Either will get you there. And we're working on a really cool app, which we expect to have out next year, but not for this season.
I don't even know what they are, Laura. What's?
I'll come down and show you how to use it.
Yeah, sure. what is the 800 number?
Okay, 888-842-2442.
Now, we had to rush you on the air because generally in the Philadelphia area, which is where the show is broadcast from, the Open Days program is sometime in June. But this year, it's right around the corner. It's May 5th, and you have an astounding 15 private gardens that are going to be on display that day.
That's right. I'm going to try and see them all. It would be a record for me on one day, but they're all fantastic. And it's early because the Garden Club of America is celebrating their 100th anniversary, and many of these gardens are open through that incredible group of volunteers. So it's in collaboration with the Garden Club of America, and it's just in a couple of weeks.
I know.
Yeah.
Where I know there's always a heavy concentration of gardens in the Philadelphia area. Where else are you big around the country? Where else do a lot of private garden owners participate in the program?
Well, of course, California, we have a great concentration of open days in the San Francisco area because we do have a West Coast office, and we're also very involved with the restoration of the gardens on Alcatraz Island. So we have about 5 Bay Area open days in San Francisco, and you have to, if you make the trip to San Francisco, be sure to visit Alcatraz because the restoration of those gardens is fabulous.
I didn't know Alcatraz had gardens.
For a very long time, since the prisoners were there, the warden and his family and the guards and all the many of the prisoners were gardening there when it was a state penitentiary.
And so, is that what the Garden Conservancy, typically in the past, I don't know if it's still the same, you would make a donation of $5 to tour each private garden, and that money would go back to the Conservancy, and they would pick a private garden or two that was in need of restoration or rebuilding. Is the Alcatraz project your main conservancy project right now?
It is in the Bay Area, as well as the Ruth Bancroft Garden, which is the garden that we were founded to preserve. It's Ruth Bancroft's garden, and that's in Walnut Creek, California, which is across the bay. So there are 2 main projects in the San Francisco area, but we have about 16 others around the country that we're still very actively involved in preserving and keeping open to the public. So a very active preservation program that the Open Days certainly supports. If you become a member of the Conservancy, you get to visit gardens for half price. So it's you can visit two for $5. Take a friend along.
Yeah, but you're mostly going to become a member of the Conservancy because you love the idea of these private gardens being saved and restored because the garden you're describing was going to go away, right?
All 18 of them, I think, were in great jeopardy of no longer being gardens before we became involved.
So where are some of the other preserved gardens or gardens that are in the act of being preserved?
There's a terrific garden called Peckerwood Garden in Hempstead, Texas. We just had our Houston Open Day in March 23rd, which helped support our preservation work at Peckerwood. John Ferry, who's the founder and still is actively gardening there, has amassed a tremendous collection of plants from Mexico and other expeditions of plant collecting. So that's one of the projects that we're currently very involved in. Also, the Humes Japanese Stroll Garden on the north shore of Long Island is a beautiful little gem of a stroll garden. It was spared from all the storms that New York experienced this winter. We've just restored the tea house there. If you haven't visited a Japanese stroll garden, you really need to see this one. There's very few examples like this in the United States.
And it did survive Sandy, huh?
It did. We were very, very fortunate. We actually have quite a few resources available to those people who are considering, you know, the future of their gardens and what's going to happen when their children inherit it maybe and are not interested in gardening there, if they have no one to leave the property to. We have a series of publications that provide a lot of good information to help people along in their thinking about what to do with their garden when they can no longer take care of it. We're always really eager to hear about anyone who's gardening anywhere around the country. If they want to participate in an open day program, if they want to help bring the program to their area, if they are interested in talking about preservation, they just should call us and we're happy to put them in the right direction.
And showing your private garden through the Conservancy's Open Days program, let's be honest, Laura, this is the ultimate in bragging rights for a gardener, right?
That's right.
But a lot of people, you and I have visited gardens on the Open Days program. This is like the best day of the year for these people. This is like Christmas and Halloween and Easter all rolled into one for them.
For gardeners, it sure is. And, you know, we hold a lot of hands for that first-time garden host, as we call them, and they fret and worry, and we do too, we think. Will the audience show up? It is always such a wonderful experience for them that we inevitably get the call the next day saying, that was fantastic, I can't wait to do it again. We have a lot of garden hosts that have been open for us since 1995. They've been at it as long as I have. It's a tremendous endorsement of how enjoyable the program can be for garden hosts. We really like to hear about those experiences, and it's evident in the fact that people come back year after year to show their gardens. And people return and visit a garden often.
Oh, and, you know, I'm impressed now. Seeing you as more of a resource than I have in the past years. I really hadn't thought about you not only adopting the occasional garden that needs preservation. But it sounds like you're the best possible resource for gardeners who fear the future for their garden.
What we've found over the years is that people come to us with varying levels of need for advice or just to start thinking about the process. So we publish a series of handbooks that talks about what's involved in actually creating your own nonprofit organization. Rallying volunteers and financial supporters certainly is a really important part of that. How you think about how your garden might change over the years so it's easier for another organization to take it over and maintain it. I mean, typically, when we're gardening in our own gardens, we're doing just crazy stuff, spending a lot of hours, not thinking about having it open to the public.
So your garden might not only be saved, it might someday become a public garden.
That's right. And a good way to start that process is to open for an open day. And you get a sense of how people respond to a garden, what a terrific resource it can be for your community, and what a great joy it is to just share a creation that you've spent a lot of time and energy working on. I think that's the real good part about gardening.
And this year's Open Days program is already ongoing. It'll come to the Philadelphia area on May 5th with 15 private gardens. That seems like a record to me, Laura.
It's pretty close. I think, you know, I actually think it may be. So I'm going to try and do them all.
That'll be May 5th in the Philadelphia area. And if you want to find out if there is an Open Days program near you, you can visit them online. Just go to the Garden Conservancy or opendaysprogram.org. Laura Palmer is Deputy Director for Administration of the Garden Conservancy. She has been director of their fabulous Open Days program since its first season in 1995. Visit them online at opendaysprogram.org or at the Garden Conservancy. And, of course, we'll put a link up at our website as well. Laura, thanks for being on You Bet Your Garden once again.
Thank you, Mike.
And now, back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Andy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Andy. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's a beautiful day today.
And where is Andy doing well?
I live in Nazareth, Pennsylvania. It's a beautiful place to garden.
All right. What can we do for Andy from Nazareth?
Well, as I said, it's a beautiful place to garden. I've lived here for 7 years. But I've developed a pretty nice garden over the last 7 years with raised beds. Listening to your show, I've gotten some pretty good advice on what to do with my tomatoes and such. And I'm pretty proud of the garden, but my company's moving me to Dallas.
Oh.
And I guess I have really two questions. First one is, what can I expect in terms of what can I actually grow in such a different climate such as Dallas, Texas? And what kind of surprises might I run into?
Well, I'm glad that you specified, because somebody who is just moving to, quote, Texas, that's like the size of many countries. But I'm very familiar with the Dallas-Fort Worth area. I have lots of friends there. The climate is much milder than Nazareth. The winters are warmer. The summers are hotter. The big problem is water, of course. You know, it's legendary when you get into the Southwest. Lack of water is an issue. So water conservation and being smart with water is very important. To answer your basic question, you will be able to grow everything that you can grow here, plus a couple of other things, and you will be able to have plants outdoors over winter that either would have died in Pennsylvania or would have had to be brought inside. You will have a much wider range of plants. And, of course, when you get to Dallas, I want you to be in touch with the local county extension office. They'll be able to instruct you better on the temperature ranges in certain months. And some of it's going to have to do with your location. If you have a choice of houses, for instance, a gardener in Dallas wants a house where the garden area gets some afternoon shade. For instance, if you were moving up north, if you were moving to Maine or something like that, you'd want the most full sun you could possibly get. In Dallas, where July and August are going to be very brutal on plants, you want a place where you can either rig up or naturally have morning sun and afternoon shade. If you do that, the only thing you're going to get is extended seasons. You'll be able to put your tomatoes out a month earlier. You'll harvest them a month later. If you extend your season right now with salad greens in the spring and fall, you can grow those outdoors all winter long. And you will be harvesting all winter long. The trick in climates like that is to think of the height of summer the way we currently think of winter. It may seem counterintuitive, but the hardest time to keep plants alive in a climate like that is in the middle of summer. So a lot of people will start their tomatoes super early, get them out at a time that we would think ridiculous, and have most of that early harvest done by the time the July heat really gets in. Then they'll do what they can to protect those plants, or they'll have like stunt plants ready to put out at the end of August because you'll have a whole other growing season. What you'll have is this bizarro winter in the middle that combined with the heat and the wind and the dryness is very stressful on the plants that we have a ball with over summer. And in the summer in Texas, that's where you'll be growing your sweet corn. In Texas, you could grow the watermelons that look like giant outdoor propane tanks. You can really go to town. You can grow those long season vegetables. And many of those are heat tolerant. But what you're looking for is, again, a place where the plants can get some respite. Full sun in Maine means full sun. When you get to like Texas and Arizona and Oklahoma, full sun means, can I please have some afternoon shade? And I would plan to be a 12-month gardener, man. You will grow the most spectacular lettuce and spinach and broccoli and kale and cabbages straight over the winter, outdoors.
Oh, that's wonderful. I thought it was going to be saying goodbye to all those leafy greens.
No, but you're going to be seeing them at a different time of year. That's what you're going to have to get used to, is the timing is going to change radically. But you'll be able to grow every plant you could here in Pennsylvania, and you'll add another 20% to your arsenal.
Well, that's certainly encouraging. Thank you.
All right. Good luck, Andy, on your great adventure.
Thank you.
Take care. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll appear at the Community Home Show in Ocean Pines, Maryland on Saturday, April 27th, at the Compost Awareness Day in Manassas on Saturday, May 4th, at the Landis Valley Museum Urban Garden Fair on May 11th, and at the 20th Annual Earth Fair in Smithville, New Jersey in June. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with instructions on how to grow your entire garden on a tabletop and more of your fascinating phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden. Burpee can help do the gardening for you with garden-ready plants, tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, herbs, and more, delivered at planting time in your region. These and more can be seen online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll be talking about growing your entire garden on top of a table. It's the way to save your back and have fun gardening again. In the meantime, however, a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Amber, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. It's nice to be here.
It's nice to have you here, Amber. Where are you?
I'm actually located outside of Muncie, Indiana.
Oh, okay. And are you calling about gardening in the Muncie area?
Yes.
Okay. What can we do for Amber near Muncie?
My tulips I planted, these were store-bought indoor greenhouse tulips, but they were so pretty. They were orange and purple hybrids.
Right.
And I planted them in my yard around the bush, and they came up this year, and they were fine, and then the frost came back, and now about half of them are yellow, and some of them have put out a green leaf or two, but I have a couple that are just sitting there, and they look all yucky and yellow and pitiful.
Okay, so that's not right, because tulips, daffodils, hyacinth, all of the spring bulbs, they have a natural antifreeze in them. So whatever's going wrong was not a surprise frost. Now, these were not tulips that you bought in a store and planted in the fall. These were tulips that you had bought forced in a pot last year. Is that correct?
Yes.
So did you get them in the springtime last year?
It was either after Easter or around Mother's Day.
Yeah, so in the springtime last year, and they were in pots, when the flowers faded, what did you do with the bulbs that you had that you eventually put in the ground?
I actually put them, I dug around this bush. It had a bunch of grass around it. My husband didn't want to mow, and so I dug the grass up. I put regular paper down because I heard that would help fight off the weeds, and I put a little layer of chocolate mulch because it just sounded really nice and it smelled really good.
Right. When you say chocolate mulch, you mean the cocoa shell mulch.
Yes.
Yeah, that, and it does smell like chocolate, doesn't it?
It does.
Yeah. So did you just immediately put these plants in the ground last spring?
Yes, I did.
Okay. And did you clip off the greens or something first?
Yes.
Okay. Now, so you made a big mistake, but your tulips are not dead yet, and they may not put on a real flowering show for you this year. But they may not have done that anyway, because forced tulips often skip a year. If you can get them to survive to begin with, they often don't have the potential to put out a flower the following year. But once they've been in the ground and gotten to their own natural cycle, they will often rebloom. So what you should have done, which is not to criticize you, but to help out everybody who has these things right now, or for instance, if you want to rescue other people's pots, now you know what to do. Clipping off the faded flowers was good. Then what you would do is you would just leave the pots out in the sunlight, and you would feed and water them just to keep the green leaves alive for as long as possible. The life cycle of a bulb is once the flower fades, the green leaves absorb nutrients, both from any nutrients in their soil and from the sun, and slowly grow the following year's flower. By the time the green leaves turn brown, which is about a month after the flowers come off, there is a new baby flower in the middle of the flower bulb that's just going to sleep there for like 10 months. And at that point, what you should do, once the leaves turn brown naturally, then you can clip them off. And then the smartest thing is just take those pots, stop watering them, don't feed them again, and just put them in the basement until Halloween. And then, like in the days after Halloween, take the bulbs out of that soil and plant them in the ground. That's how the Dutch bulb growers do it, and that gets the bulb back into the cycle. There's nothing wrong with cocoa shell mulch. I'm not quite sure what the paper's doing there. If the paper is still in existence, I would get rid of that. And the yellow leaves, by the way, are a sign of just low nutrition. The bulbs didn't get fed last year. But some of the bulbs have green leaves, or some of the leaves are green?
Yes.
Well, as long as you have green leaves, those bulbs can be fed. This is the time to go out and get a gentle organic plant food. Something like a fish and seaweed mix, for instance. Something that's going to be active right away. Not a granular fertilizer, because that takes a little bit of time to get active. I would like you to use a gentle organic liquid fertilizer. Give them a feeding and get rid of any paper there, but otherwise, that's fine. Leave the green leaves alone. They may not look their best this year, but they will turn dramatically different when they are brown and ready to die. And then when that happens, you can certainly clip them off. And then just make sure that area does not get overwatered over the summer. And Then, the following spring, a year from now, I predict you'll have beautiful leaves come up and some tulips.
Yay!
Okay, Amber?
Okay.
All right. Well, good luck with your tulips. And there's, like they say in baseball, there's always next year.
Okay, good. I'm so glad. I thought I somehow killed them all.
No, they're pretty tough characters. All right, Amber, good luck.
Thank you.
Take care. 1-888-346-9499. Lynn, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am doing very well, Lynn. How are you?
I'm great.
And where is Lynn great?
I live in Millville, Pennsylvania, which is sort of near Bloomsburg. It's north central.
Oh, okay.
It's about 9 miles north of Interstate 80 as it's going across the state.
I know that.
I used to be in South Jersey.
Yes.
My whole life.
Oh, okay.
So anyway, now I'm up here on a little bit less than 4-acre farm. I moved up about 11 years ago, 12 years ago, actually. And I have two horses, and most of it's in pasture. My house and the barn sort of, and the driveway sort of take up like an acre. I have a lot of sawdust that I separate from the manure. And because I found that it doesn't compost very easily, it seems to take a lot more than the manure. I went online and learned all about making compost, you know, manure composting bins. And I, you know, so I separate it. And now I have a mountain of the sawdust that was used in the stalls. And I would like to know if I could put it on my, you know, in my garden as a mulch and in my flower bed as a mulch. It's just there.
Now, let's drop back a little bit. When horses are in a stall, there is bedding material to keep the floor of the stall from becoming slippery and to keep things a little bit neater. So when that material is swept out, it's a combination of the two things the horse was done with and those stable sweepings. Most of the people who I know keep horses, they use straw. And when the straw and the manure is piled up in a big pile, it all tends to compost down very fast. But what you get is composted horse manure, not compost. So your manure management plan seems fine. The horses are eating the pasture grass. The horses are giving you back some form of the pasture grass. And then a year later, you're using that to feed the pasture grass. That's the perfect closed circle on a place like yours. The sawdust that you're separating out is more problematic. Wood chips are the same way. They are very resistant to composting. And the problem is woody material like this, especially tiny particles of woody material like this, tend to absorb nutrients from the soil. So when people use wood chips as mulch, some of the wood chip goes to like stealing food from their plants. But when the source of the wood is very small in particle size, like the sawdust, the nitrogen theft becomes larger. It has nothing good for plants in it, and it will steal their food on the way to becoming a soil, which it will eventually. But in the meantime, especially sawdust has a tendency to mingle with the soil. And once the wood gets into the soil, it almost becomes a plant killer. So I would not use that sawdust. If anything, I would spread it maybe in an area where there's noxious weeds so it would steal their food. Use it as a killing mulch. If you have some plants coming up that are dangerous to horses, dump like a foot of this sawdust on top of it and just smother them. Otherwise, if you pile it up and you can mix in a high source of nitrogen like grass clippings or coffee grounds, or I would have said horse manure, it will eventually become soil. You may be surprised. If you pile up sawdust for 2 years, it may appear to be nothing but a pile of sawdust to you. But because it was once in the stall and it was exposed to manure and urine, I bet you the bottom of that pile is already good compost.
Yeah, I'm sure it is too, because it's been there a while. So do you think that I'm wrong in separating it?
The bigger the pile, the more grass clippings, the more manure, that sawdust will become compost, and that is the place where it will become compost the fastest. I fear you may be giving yourself extra work by separating it out, because in its current form, it's useful for as an herbicide. So you might want to think of it that way. If you have an area with some problem plants, smother it with the sawdust. Otherwise, yes, stop separating it out and let it compost with the rest of the manure.
Yeah.
All right?
All right. Well, that certainly will save me plenty of sorting, won't it?
Yes, and that's what we're here for. We're here to save people's backs. Okay, Lynn?
Okay.
All right, you take
Thank
care
you.
Now.
It's
Bye-bye.
Nice to talk to you.
You too.
Bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. Tired of bending over? Try gardening on a tabletop. Jolie Hagazi, filling in for our producer, Alexis Landis. Would you read the first question, please?
Sure, Mike. We heard from Rosalie in Ardmore, PA. She writes, I have a bad back and I'm looking for some kind of raised bed to grow vegetables and herbs that won't require any bending. The space I have available is between 3x3 and 3x5. I'd ideally like something with wheels so I can move it around for optimum light. What do you recommend?
I don't recommend the people with bad backs try and push heavy things around, so let's ditch those wheels. But I know for a fact that you can grow a surprising amount of stuff in a 3x3-foot space, because that's the size of an outdoor table I currently have covered with plants on our patio. It's part of a set we bought years ago, a circular wrought iron table with four chairs and an umbrella for the middle. You'll find similar pieces at every home store in the country. Right now, I have six rectangular containers on top of mine. Each one is 18 inches long and about 6 inches wide and high. The regular window box style planters you'll find at any garden center. I have some larger rectangular ones, but they're heavy, so they stay on the ground. The 18-inch size is easy to lift, even when it's filled with plants and wet soil, and I like being able to move my containers without giving my aging back any bright ideas. I drilled some extra drainage holes in the bottoms, which I always do, and filled the containers with a mixture of soil-free mix and compost, as any good container should be filled with. They're currently growing a lot of salad greens and pansies, plus spring bulbs that I successfully forced in a downstairs fridge. When the weather gets warmer, those cool season plants will get swapped out with herbs, peppers, little gourmet eggplants, bush string beans, and summer flowers like edible nasturtiums, which should look great trailing over the side of the table. Arrange things well, and you'll even have enough room in the middle for a patio-sized tomato plant in a round pot. Or position a cherry tomato so the vines trail over the side of the table. You can sit in one of the chairs to play with your plants or stand next to the table to tend and pick, whatever you feel like that day. I grow more and more in containers that are up on easy-to-reach platforms like this every season, as I have long ago lost any love of bending over. A few years from now, I may only have big plants like full-size tomatoes and raspberries in the actual ground.
Mike, we also heard from Autumn near Walnut Creek, California. She writes, I plant vegetable gardens professionally, and I'm installing a new raised plant bed that will be about 32 inches tall for a client who needs to be able to reach the plants standing up instead of bending over. I usually fill new beds with half compost and soil-free mix, but in one of your previous questions of the week, you recommend filling the bottom of a tall bed like this with rocks and then soil on the top. Is putting rocks in the bottom better than filling it all up with compost? I usually try to have 2 feet of compost and soil-free mix in my beds. I would love to get your recommendation. I enjoy listening to your show while I work in the garden. Thank you.
Well, you caught me, Autumn. Years ago, I did suggest that somebody building a super tall, sky-high bed put some kind of fill in the bottom, because the alternative seemed like a potentially expensive waste of good compost, and I was concerned about drainage issues. But I have since come to realize that there's no need to build a giant tower, with or without rocks. Such a structure would, by its very nature, be ungainly and prone to failure. And you can accomplish the same height goal with less weight, work, and inputs by gardening in containers on tabletops. As the years creep up on us, more and more gardeners are going to need to find a way to tend their plants while either sitting down or standing up. And while helping design a garden that would be wheelchair accessible a few years back, the idea came to me. Find sturdy tables of the correct height that fit the space. Cover the tops of the tables with rectangular planters filled with compost and soil-free mix, and you can grow a huge diversity of plants without any back pain. Think of picnic tables or the wide variety of patio tables that are available in every shape and size. They're designed for outdoor use, and they're just at the right height. You could even position a big 17-inch pot on the ground at each end of a table and grow a couple of full-size tomato plants. No more bending, no more weeding, everything at arm's height, easy to pick, easy to touch and smell. Getting on in years, got a concrete backyard, renting where you live, or you just might have to move. Get some tables and containers and have the garden you want. Perhaps the garden of the future. Well, that sure was some interesting information about growing on top of a table now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website, where you can read it over with links to lots more information about container gardening. Just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes, my producer is threatening to lay me out on a table if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live in your email. Maybe put the actual subject in the subject line. And always check first to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week. Find the solution to every garden problem in our Garden Answers A to Z section. Listen to this show, listen to old shows, download this week's podcast, and follow us on Facebook. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Al Banks. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar are You Bet Your Garden's internet illuminati. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at our Facebook page. We had very special help this week from our new intern, Jolie Higazi, and from our new assistant editor, Cecily Garber. Our esteemed editor, Al Banks, always edits the show on top of a table. Working at a table most of the time is our producer, Alexis Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. I'm your patio prima donna, Mike McGrath, and I'll see you next week. Although many people focus on kitchen waste, you can't make good compost without a lot of dry brown materials in the mix. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, I'll explain how to make compost without fall leaves. Plus your fabulous phone calls.